introduced you with my mute button on, so that didn't work very well.
Well, thank you for the introduction and welcome, Bill.
Go ahead.
I say we're here tonight to talk about the recent Black Lives Matter protests in the United States and the fact that in America, blacks are still far more likely than any other population to be arrested, convicted, and imprisoned. At the same time, our undocumented immigrants, our immigrant communities, they're faced by detention from ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and often profiled through police and other activities here in the United States. So what happens when a undocumented immigrant is also a black person? Many of our immigrants are black, either coming directly from Africa or from South America and Central America. There are many immigrants of African descent all over the world, and a lot of these people end up in the United States. So what happens when a black Latinx is swept up in the ICE detention system? With us tonight, we have Jessica Piedra, an immigration attorney, and two black immigrants, Samantha and Karina, who can help share us our story. And perhaps we could start with Karina, if we can, if you could tell us a little bit about your story. And, how has being a black immigrant affected your life?
Thank you for having us. I'm glad to be here sharing my brother's story with you all. So I'm here mainly on behalf of my brother, Giancarlo Jimenez Joseph, who died by suicide in 2017 in detention in ICE custody. His death affected us in profound ways. Prior to his detention and his death, we were not aware of the challenges that immigrants face in detention, at least not to the level that they are. And my family decided that we were going to pursue some ways of activism so that we can help, so that we can do something and help it so that this doesn't happen to anyone else. And that's why I'm here today sharing a story. But essentially, my brother, who was also a Black Latino or Afro-Latino, he was, I believe, racially profiled. He was basically stopped while brown, right? He was in a car, in a vehicle, and he fell within the big percentage of people in this country who are immigrants who are brown or black, and unfortunately, they are pulled over for one reason or another, and then they end up scooped up by ICE. With Gene, I'm sure we'll talk more about this tonight, but his issue was that, or the issue that ICE had, or local enforcement had with him, was that they noticed a misdemeanor on his record, and it was strictly about his criminal record, and none of it was really immigration or an immigration violation. So that was enough for them to put a whole ICE hold on him, and ICE scooped him up. And unfortunately, my brother suffered from schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, which was made known to the immigration facility where he was held. On the day that he arrived, they have to screen detainees and screen for those things, and they were fully aware of his condition. And the fact that he needed special treatment and needed not to be in a place like that, but needed to be in a medical facility instead. So with Gene is how we call my brother. He ended up in solitary confinement because that's one of the ways that they treat people with his mental condition. People that are mentally ill end up in solitary confinement away from the general population, for different reasons that they, they make up reasons and excuses. One of them is, he's could harm others and he's at risk of harming himself. So we don't, we want to make sure that we place him in a place where we could watch him. Well, at every turn, ICE broke their policies with my brother. They did not watch him. They did not follow their own policies that they have in place where you're supposed to be watching him every 15 minutes or 30 minutes or so. My brother ended up in solitary for 19 days. On the 19th day, he took his life with a sheet, with his own bed sheet. And he unfortunately, you know, his time in there got prolonged because he did not have the legal representation that he needed at the time. He, first of all, did not even have it at the stage, the initial stages where you can get a bond, you know, your bond hearing. And so we were trying from the outside, my family and I, just really fighting for him and trying to get him that proper legal representation. But the way that the system is set up, they made it very difficult for Gene to, first of all, even get a G-28 from his attorney. We found him an attorney. We faxed over a G-28. His ICE officer was very hard to get a hold of.
Can you tell the audience what a G-28 is?
So the G-28 is the notice of appearance for USCIS to know that person has an attorney, right, and will represent them in their case. The reason we had that for him is because we were going to attempt to file for a U visa for him. He had been physically assaulted by another detainee in that facility. And we tried to, so this was going to be a form of relief for him. We were trying to look for angles to get him out of there. And we tried to, first of all, get it reported with the local authorities there, and they claimed they had no jurisdiction. So in order to get a G-28 on file, you need an official police report. So at every turn, we were faced with challenges. Communication with the ICE officer was very, very difficult. Gene never got the G-28 that we faxed over for him in all 3 months that he was there. He also didn't get his commissary money that we sent him for peanut butter. He was craving things that, you know, we take for granted out here, but detainees don't often get to, you know, partake of or get their hands on. And so his story is very tragic because it shouldn't have happened. You shouldn't have been there. But if someone does end up there, their time in detention should not be prolonged like his was. You know, they kept continuing his court date. They did that about twice, I believe. So that just meant he had to stay there until he saw a judge. He came before a judge. And he didn't know how to navigate. This immigration system is so complex. There's so much bureaucracy to navigate on your, and if you do it on your own, it's an impossible situation. So for him not to have the legal representation, for him not to have the medical assistance, the medical treatment that his mental illness warranted, that was a major breach and violation of his civil rights, of his human rights. And like I said, eventually it just led to his death, his tragic, sudden death. And unfortunately, Gene was the first Latino, the first Black Latino to die in immigration detention after the current administration took office. And after his death, I believe about two or three other detainees have died in that same facility. So that tells me that they do not take the life of the individual serious they don't value the life of the individual, and they do not take these incidents as serious as they should be taking them, because if it keeps happening over and over again. And this is not Stewart Detention Center. It's where he was held and died. It's not the only immigration detention facility in the country where other immigrants are taking their own lives and are dying, not just of mental illness, but other acute conditions that they have that in the end, their death is preventable. But because they aren't considered, there's just not enough. The money is not being allocated where it should go. The greed goes very deep. The corruption goes very deep. You know, it's all about maintain a certain number of vets at all times occupied, as ICE is contracting with private companies that run these places in many cases. And so we would like to see all of that go away. We would like to see a change where we don't have these systems in place that are motivated, that the people in charge are not motivated by the money and the profit in spite of the life of the individual.
Of course. So your family's from Panama, is that correct?
Correct.
Correct. And at the time, and I assume earlier, Gene and other members of the family qualified for the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
So at the time Gene was detained, there really was no immigration issues outstanding for him?
Not to my knowledge. The officer that detained him, I believe that since he had his documentation on him, and he was protected by his DACA from deportation, not necessarily from detention, but at least deportation. You know, his issue was something that, like I said, he had a misdemeanor on the record, and I believe he had missed the court date. And by the way, I'd like to make a parenthesis here and just vouch for my brother and just say that the reason he had a misdemeanor is because of his mental illness and it not being treated at the time. He was just in a state in his life where he was not himself. So this misdemeanor, you know, it led to him missing a court date, and when he got stopped, that was enough for the officer to arrest him. Enough for ICE to keep him, despite the fact that he had DACA status, which protected him from deportation.
Do you feel like his African descent, do you feel like there was a profiling pattern there that picked him up where perhaps another person may not have been?
Well, I do see a pattern, and in the research that I've done, I do see a pattern of anti-Blackness in the in this detention machine that we have, this regime that we have, where, you know, it's enough to see, and this is one of the similarities that I find with the African-American community too, or anyone who is your skin, if you're not white, there's an automatic assumption about you. There's an immediate reason for any officer at any given point to stop you and question you. With my brother, he looked black. He looked straight up black and not Latino. And so I believe that just by looking at him and then finding that on his record, there were no additional questions asked. That was enough for the officer to arrest him and take him away.
And because he was an immigrant at that point, they were able to bring ICE into this and move him into the detention situation you described.
Correct.
Very sorry to hear that. Samantha, I know that you were born in Kenya and brought to the United States when you were quite young, fourth grade, and you're also a DACA recipient at this point. But can you tell us a little bit about your experience with America and, you know, your recent detention, and share your story with us?
Of course. Thank you, Bob. With my story, it was something that I didn't think would ever happen to me, and more so the way my immigration situation started, the way where a certain county was trying to paint like a certain picture of me, and they had found out that I had just had knee surgery, and in October, and in November, my DACA lapsed. My job knew about it. They were okay with it because I was on bed rest. The HR department called me and said, wait until you get back to work and then you can get the money for it and refile. So don't worry about it. And so what happened is, basically Karina is right. They find anything that they can possibly find. And for me, it was an old insurance ticket and from 2017. And at that time we were in 2019 that they had been sending to an old address. So I had no notification of it. And I used that as a way to put me in the ICE detention center. And used the fact that my DACA had lapsed, even though they knew that it was off of a financial situation to which, and I quote, the officer said, oh, we see financial hardships all the time, to which I thought they would understand, but they did not. They still transferred me to their headquarters. So the way this all started was due to profiling, due to me being Black and trying to fight for my child. And then coming into where someone wanted to find anything they could possibly find on me, then using my immigration status as a weapon for the campaign, and using an old insurance ticket, knowing that ICE usually targets people who are put in the detention center with basically the most minor things. You can go in there with a speeding ticket, and as soon as ICE, gets information of that, they will put an ICE hold on you, so the jail can release you. Like when I went to Grandview for the insurance ticket, the judge didn't even bother to see me. He was explaining my situation. I had no notification of it, but since it had been so long, he was like, I won't put any points on your driver's license. Pay a $25 fine, and you're good to go. I thought I was good to go, and as soon as I was given the paper, I was like, okay, when do I get released? And the sheriff there said, oh, well, I didn't tell you when they transferred you from Clay County that someone over there alerted ICE. And I was like, no, what do you mean? I've never come in contact with ICE before. They're like, well, they just want to come and ask questions. When they came, officers, I explained to them everything. They're, your DACA has lapsed. I was like, yes, it was due for me having knee surgery and not being able to work on short-term disability cut down after a while. They're like, okay, we see financial hardships all the time. And I was like, okay. And when I said, okay, they're like, but we're going to have to keep you in handcuffs and transfer you down to our headquarters. As that, I was confused. And I thought it was just something simple. So they transferred me down to the headquarters, and when we get there, they wanted names of family members. They wanted, my kid's name, my mom's names, address, phone numbers, and that wasn't relevant to anything that to do with my case. And when I refused, and I refused to sign without counsel, not only did they write on the paperwork, refuse to sign, but they also said, well, you were cooperating pretty well, but since you won't get information we need, we're going to take that as no cooperation, and you get no bond. And the ICE officer looks me in the face while questioning me and says, so what border did you cross? And I kind of looked at him, I was a little confused, and I don't know what was really running through his head, and I was like, I didn't cross a border, I flew here. And basically when I told him that I flew here, he was like, no, you didn't. And so whenever I told him, no, I didn't, come here through a border, I flew here. He wanted to say, well, there's no recollection of that, to which I told him I'm on DACA. Oh, sorry. And, you can check, my, DACA information where my passport is, and you can see it was stamped, at the border that occurred, at the checkpoint. And he was like, well, that's not on there. So, we don't believe you. And I was transferred to Caldwell County. When I was transferred to Caldwell County, that county in the middle of nowhere in Kingston, Missouri, and they were holding detainees there all the way from federal indictments, conspiracy theories and such. And it got to the point where there's people in there not necessarily very friendly, and I had no bond, so I wasn't able to get out. I was there for 3 weeks. I had to make sure that I used my phone call wisely. There was a Guatemalan girl who was in there that didn't speak English, and I came in there before her, and I left before her. And that's not okay. And I knew exactly what she was in there for, and it wasn't anything to be able to hold her for that long, but since she wasn't able to advocate for herself, and she wasn't able to know that the resources that were out there would basically take advantage of that. And since I voiced my opinion and I told them, here, the paperwork states that I can see a judge. You guys have 10 days to let me see a judge for my bond, whether I have counsel, whether I don't. The only way it can be continued is if I ask for it to be continued to get more time to find counsel. They had me have a court date by the 10th day, but she had been there longer than me and she had a court date. When we had the court date, the ICE officer, their ICE attorney, the judge wanted to let me go on my own recognizance, just signature bond, instead of the ICE attorney told him he could not do that. And I find out the average bond, I got the lowest bond. So since the judge couldn't sign me out on my own recognizance, since ICE told him he couldn't do that, he gave me the lowest bond for ICE, which is $1,500. Their average bond is $10,000. And a lot of people don't know with ICE, there's no 10%, there's no finding a bondsman. You have to pay the full amount out front for them to release you. And no one had that kind of money. So in a way, it was a blessing in disguise that ICE wasn't the one that set my bond at that time. But the judge was able to see all the character reference letters that the community and my family wrote and go by that. And he was the one to make the decision. But I tried to stop him from me. And thank God to the DDLN and Air KC, they were able to help me not only get a lawyer for my bond hearing, but as well as my bond, because and caused a lot of financial hardships to family when they don't have the money available. And not to mention, if your lawyer sends you anything in the detention center, as far as correspondence, they make you pay for that.
I know Karina and I was speaking with South American, a Latin descent recently, Christopher, and he was telling us a story about him and five other immigrants were detained, put into a transport vehicle, and because the other detainees weren't presenting as Black, they actually got strapped down, restrained in the vehicle, and apparently Christopher was not. Remember that story, Karina? Could you share some details on that?
Sure. I don't have all the details, Bob, but you're right. With Christopher, his... Again, his story is unfair and sad again, because he was not the only one in the van not strapped. And the detainees were speaking Spanish in the back. From what Christopher tells me, the driver became upset and hit the brakes really, really fast. Christopher went flying from the back of the van to the front of the van in an attempt to protect his face. He used his elbow and fractured it in different places. He spent about 3 weeks at the detention facility before he got seen by a professional. And when he was finally seen by a professional, he was, they placed a cast on him. That's how you call that, right? A cast.
Right. Yes.
But they put him in solitary confinement with the cast because they were saying that if others saw him with it, it would be a reason for them to, you know, he'd be in danger, to bully him. But being in solitary meant that he didn't have access to communication to the outside, including his attorney. So again, navigating that whole system for him with his physical condition, and he actually became, he had anxiety before going into that place. His anxiety, his mental health exacerbated. It just got it got really bad, and he came out of there with an elbow that was broken in several places. With his mental illness got worse, and he finally was able to hire an attorney for his case. He got bond, And I understand that a big part of that, DDLN played some part in that as well, for his bond, for him to get his bond. And my brother's foundation, we have a foundation, it's called the Gene Foundation, also stepped in to help him and his friend who, through his friend, he got an attorney, wonderful attorney. And, you know, it's really sad that he was discriminated on so many levels, discriminated against on so many levels while in there. He talked to me about how when they got to the detention facility, he, because he was a Black immigrant, he instantly got placed with the Blacks in the room. So they segregated them. They separated the immigrants based on the color of their skin. You know, I can only imagine what something like that does to an individual who you don't speak the language, like Amanda was saying, and you don't have anyone vouching for you, you don't have an attorney who knows the law, who is fighting for you, but you understand the disparities, you understand the racism in your heart. You know that you are being discriminated against and treated subpar as an individual, as a human being.
When I was listening to Christopher's story, it really struck me just how typical American Black it is. I mean, the fact that he was an immigrant was almost secondary to the fact that he was profiled as a Black person and treated in ways that are unfortunately very common in this country. Jessica, immigration attorney, I know you've worked a great deal, not only with immigrants representation, but, you know, you've also served as president of the Lawyers Guild, National Lawyers Guild here in Kansas City, and you've been organizing legal advisors to show up at the Kansas City Black Lives Matter protest. Can you speak a little bit about your experience with being Black and immigrant, you know, your clients?
Yeah, I mean, I think we see, you know, just like both of our wonderful guests, and thank you, you know, for sharing your specific stories. Just what we see is that the over-policing, it starts with racial profiling. I mean, we have a terrible problem with that here locally in Missouri, and then moves on to more aggressive prosecution, you know, and then more convictions for Black folks, immigrants, or Americans. That's what we see, you know, across the board in that scenario. That's what my own pro bono case that I helped with my client from Kenya, the minor criminal thing that he had, like Karina said, I think if he wasn't Black, he would have been referred to mental health court and not had a conviction that would have required mandatory detention and resulted in him being in the county jail for, you know, for 9 long months on a very, very minor minor issue, but he wouldn't have even been convicted of it had he not had the bias, you know, been a victim of the bias in the system at every level. And so it was just heartbreaking, really. And he suffered the same thing that Karina was talking about, where locally, we don't have immigration detention centers like the one that Gene was detained in Stewart, which in some ways is good because those places are terrible places. But on the other hand, they go to county jails that have a financial incentive to fill those beds with immigrants that I paid them to house immigrants. And it was a similar thing. He was there, you know, for a long time in a very rural area in Missouri, and they were having a hard time. They put him, you know, he was an immigrant, so they put him with the Mexicans, but he couldn't speak Spanish, and so that was very lonely and not, and then they put him, you know, and then they segregated him again, and it just felt, you know, very unsafe being in there with people who had been convicted or, you know, that had been, had been convicted of really serious crimes, that he was stuck in there, really just because of the immigration enforcement. And so, yes, I mean, we see the injustice and the overlapping there of what all Black people in America suffer, and then with the added aggressiveness of the immigration enforcement on top of that, that it often has really devastating devastating results, whether it's, you know, we're terribly tragedy of Jean Carlos, loss of life. We've dedicated this organization, you know, to his memory, or whether it's, you know, the prospect of, you know, in this case, we won because, you know, had he been deported back to his home country of Kenya, after not having been there since he was four, you know, we proved that he would probably be killed immediately. And so that would have been a really terrible result that resulted in us winning, but him being then detained for another 3 months after we won for procedural things. Just every step of the immigration enforcement mechanism is more unfair than you can possibly imagine, really. And I'm proud to stand, you know, with this organization and with these with our immigrant brothers and sisters to fight it.
Absolutely, and you're referring to the Deportation Defense Legal Network.
Do you want me to talk a little more about DDLN, or?
I want to talk a little bit more about the
JL. Okay, so we started DDLN a couple of years ago. I was a founding member, and I really appreciate Bob for having the vision and the organization to get it going. What we do is train non-immigration attorneys to take bond cases, you know, for folks. So nationally, only about 14% of detained immigrants are able to obtain immigration representation to help them get out of jail. Can you imagine you're in detention, like Samantha was telling us that the phone calls are not free. They're very expensive out of immigration detention because technically it's civil. So they don't have a lot of the rights that a criminal detainee would have. And so what we see as a result from that is only about 2% of unrepresented, which is the majority of immigrants, actually even are able to win their case and get themselves out of detention. And so that's where we're really trying to fill the gap with the deportation. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's where we're trying to really fill the gap with. Okay, would you like to, I mean, honestly, Samantha, would you like to speak to that as helping with the Know Your Rights things, or would you like me to?
Let's look at the jail systems a little bit more before we move into that. Is everybody with me?
Well, so locally, like I said, we don't have
can you hear us, Jessica?
And so what Samantha described is that they transfer folks to the main ICE officing to assign them an immigration number, and then they're transferred to a variety of local jails, county jails, not Jackson County, but the outer, like Platte County would be the closest. My client that I was discussing was held at Morgan County, and that's about 2.5 hours away, which creates, you know, an additional barrier to, you know, his family was unable to visit him. As his lawyer, I think I was only able to visit him about 3 or 4 times in the 9 months that he was detained because it's an all-day trip out there. And so it creates real barriers to representation as well. Caldwell County, Samantha references, about an hour away and has very difficult visitation procedures. It was difficult as an attorney to get in there and for us to be able to communicate by phone with folks in that detention center. Yes, I can now.
I think there's a little delay going on between our.
Sure.
I wanted to explore the.
Go ahead. Yes, I can
experience.
Hear you.
Good. Thank you. I want to explore the. The experience.
Okay, you hear us? That is there any trouble there? You'll tell us, right? Okay. I think we should move on, Bob. What would you like to add to that?
Can you hear me? Okay.
Okay, I don't think this should be dead air, so I'm going to tell something else until you can hear me. Are you not able to hear me, Bob?
I can hear you. Can you hear me? Okay, you're talking over me. Let me take over for a while here. Let's go back to Samantha. I know that you spent some time in Caldwell. You said 3 weeks. As several of you have mentioned, this is ICE contracting with county jails. So these are the same jails that all people resident in America will get into, you know, whether you're Black or an immigrant or any other person that's arrested and sent to jail. You're all in the same population. So Samantha, can you tell us about your experience in jail a little bit? I know as a Black person in jail, did you feel threatened by that? In terms of immigration, you know, was it more threatening to be a Black person or an immigrant in jail?
Honestly, Bob, both. Jail is not for me. I mean, I found that out real quick. It's not for me. It's one of those things where hygiene alone is something for just normal people, right? But then you start getting into people of color, and you start running into people in jail who proudly say that they're Aryan, proudly say that they do not like people of color. I had a girl walk into the room I was in, and she had just gotten there from prison, and she was staying there her pretrial, and she says, she was talking to one of my roommates, and she says, yeah, I don't like it. And then she notices me on the bunk under, and I didn't say anything to her. I was reading a book, and she goes, I didn't mean to say, like, I don't, like, not all Blacks. And she kind of tried to defend herself. And I looked at her and I was like, it's okay. It's fine. You don't have to, you know, try to defend it if, you know, I was not even trying to say the wrong thing at the wrong time. You know, I was there and my whole point was to get home and to get out because anything can happen in there. And when I say anything can happen a couple days after that, there's a couple of girls who proudly told me, one girl specifically, I would, in a lesser word, beat your butt, basically. And then I ended up getting put in protective custody. And the day after, I had to write a whole report to the warden because the way that the correctional officer dealt with it there, instead of separating the girls who were threatening me and the rest of the people there, they went ahead and just put me in protective custody because, like one thing Karina said with the U visa, if somebody who is in the jail abuses someone who is an immigrant at the jail and they're a citizen, you're not. Usually with a policy, apparently you're supposed that instantly, you can get a U visa on that. And, this girl, said that, and then I heard a correctional officer say under his breath, oh, she probably wanted to get her butt beat because so she can go ahead and get, a visa. I was on the phone with my mom. I went ahead and let my mom, he heard me tell my mom. And then after that, he just went quiet and his sergeant ignored what he said because he was trying to be funny in a way. But I'm pretty sure if I was my skin color and I wasn't an immigrant, that probably wouldn't have left his mouth. And after I was in protective custody, and I wrote a whole entire report, because one thing I've done is I've taken my correctional officer test in Jackson County and have passed. So I know how they're supposed to do things there and how they're not. Now, they don't know that about me. So what I did is I asked to go put in a ticket for the warden, because when they come back during the business day hours, she'll be able to see it. So I wrote a whole report for the warden about what happened, and explained how I thought it should go, meaning those girls who were threatening everyone should have been put in segregation to stay away from everyone so nothing bad happens, and, you know, nobody else should be punished, because when you're put in protective custody, it's really like you're by yourself. It's like a form of segregation, basically. I was put at the very front, the holding cell. You know, if you, if people remember, Caldwell County recently was known for being the county with, you know, a suspect that was put in there for the two missing Wisconsin brothers. And so you end up being in there with someone like that, literally next to them. And you're sitting here wondering, why am I getting punished for somebody else threatening me? And I try to explain that to the guards, but they didn't really have an own explanation. They wanted to do it the way they wanted to do it. And so when the warden got back the next day, she read my report, and she ended up actually doing what was on the report and giving the discipline to those girls and actually putting them in administrative segregation as punishment for about 14, I think it was either 14 or 7 days. And she ended up moving me back. But I ended up finding out too late that my cellmate actually got beat up by three girls, three on one. And that was right after I left. And that could have been totally avoided if they would have done things the wrong way. It clearly shows, you know, just kind of like the disheartening part about they don't really pay attention to people in there. It takes about 15 minutes for someone to ring the intercom for a guard to ask you what's wrong, if you need anything. It takes 15 minutes for them to answer, and that's quickly. 15 is quick. And they can see on the cameras, and negligent at its best, honestly.
Do you have the sense, I mean, obviously you were in the middle of this and experienced this yourself, did you have the sense that Black immigrants are more exposed to violence than perhaps other groups in jail?
Yeah, yes. They are more exposed to violence just because of racism doesn't stop at the jail front door. You know, you're in there with people from, you know, different walks of life, people who openly in jail, you know, it's dog eat dog world, and people will openly hate you, will openly tell you, I don't like you because of your skin color, and I will make sure I make your life, you know, really hard in here because of the skin color you do have. And in jail, it's much harder because it's not just, you know, one person that you meet on the street that doesn't like your skin color or someone you might run into haphazardly. It's people constantly you're around, and they run in groups.
Karina, I know your brother was in jail, but your experience communicating with your brother, trying to reach out your brother through the jail system, did you feel like his Black Latinx profile was putting him at greater risk? I think you're muted. Let me unmute you.
Excuse me.
There you go.
Yes, I feel that overall his race played a part in the fact that he was profiled while being detained. Like I said, from the very beginning of his journey, being detained at the local jail, all the way through him being placed in solitary confinement. I don't believe Gene would have ended up under ICE custody in the first place if he wasn't a Black Latino.
Jessica, I had a question for you. I mean, I think we all clearly understand that there's the people running the jails, they have a certain attitude. What about the immigration court itself? I know that's a separate court from traditional courts, an administrative court that's run separately from the other U.S. court systems. Do you get the sense that, Black people are more likely to be profiled through immigration court? And I do understand like 1 in 5 immigrants are of African descent. So it is a fairly large community running through that court. What's your opinion there?
Yeah, I think it's a similar issue where, you know, we see, like, I work more on the affirmative side, but where we see there's more fraud allegations and other kinds of things that are just, you know, less, like, a lot of times in immigration court, it comes down to credibility. And so the biases in the system are, you know, easy to see that if, you know, that the American justice system has the biases against African immigrants. We'll see more, you know, but I think more often the reason that they're overly represented is this sort of pipeline where it comes down to racial profiling in the first place, and then the over-prosecution of Black people, and then they end up in with immigration consequences, because that's really been a shift. Started sort of towards the end of the Obama era, where they started focusing more on criminal actions, but even in immigration, very minor things can get you into trouble. And then moving into now the third year of the Trump administration, immediately they discarded any kind of prioritization of who should be prosecuted. So we're seeing, you know,
you seem to have lost your sound, Jessica. We apologize for the sound. We're all on a Zoom conference here, so, you know, sometimes our connections will go in and out. We're done.
Oh, we're done.
Oh, we're still going to go. We're down to the last few minutes. I know we've been seeing the Black Lives Matter, the protests, which is you know, happening in the news and so important. I want to give each of you a chance to comment on that. You know, starting with Samantha, how are these protests affecting you? And what do you hope that they achieve?
I just hope that the narrative is heard, and I also hope that people don't lose momentum. Usually we see a lot of people speaking about it, being passionate about it, and then the momentum dies and everyone forgets about it. So with my hope now is that people have seen enough, had enough, and are not afraid to speak out. And like I always say, the people who are spewing hate, who are out there to create a who are out there, they're not scared of voicing their opinions. So why should the good people be afraid of standing up for what's right as well? A lot of people, you know, don't speak up because of fear of retaliation or just fear alone. And we just have to, you know, stop being afraid and actually speak up, because the people who are spewing the hate and, you know, just doing things that are not right, they're not scared of the consequences, and they're not scared to let people know exactly what they think. So I just feel like the people should stand up as well and make it known that this is not going to be tolerated anymore. It's inhumane. It's just not right.
Okay, thank you. And Karina, how are the Black Lives Matter protests affecting you? What do you hope they achieve?
Yes, so I'm just echoing Samantha's words here, and I just hope this mass criminalization of Black Americans and mass incarceration of Black Americans, and beyond that, the mass detentions that we're seeing now with immigrants overall, I hope that we can put an end to that for once and for all. We're having the conversations in this nation now that we've been uncomfortable around and not willing to go into. I think, you know, after George Floyd, it's impossible to ignore anymore. And I'm glad that we are having these conversations, but we need to go beyond that. At this point, what I hope to see is all of us who are out here fighting, who are out here speaking, amplifying the voices of the marginalized, of the oppressed, we're doing it because we really need to see a gutting of the system. I hope that with through all of this, at the end of the day, we can see a restructuring of the of policing system, of the prison complex system, of the court system as well. It's going to take a lot to make that happen, but we have to start somewhere. And until we do that, I don't think that we can see true change in our nation. So that has to happen. But I also, with the conversations that we're having, I want to see a change in the hearts of people, especially maybe someone who thinks to themselves, well, I can't do anything about it, or it's not my fault. I haven't done anything wrong. So why get involved? I think, you know, like Martin Luther King Jr. said, Dr. King, I love this quote, and I always take the opportunity to remind people that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and that whenever we have injustice in one sphere of society, that is a cancer that is going to spread, right, to all spheres of society. So if it is a problem for one group of people in our nation, then it's all of our problem. It's all of our problem. And so I just want to see the hearts of people starting to shift and our systems starting to shift as well. I hope, like Amanda said, that people do not forget that we don't just, you know, we're having the conversations, we're fighting for justice, for change. I hope that we don't get back to scrolling through our feet again and just going about life, just doing life as usual.
Thank you. And Jessica, as I mentioned earlier, you're on the ground with these protests in Kansas City. You've been doing legal observing. What are you hoping that we can achieve through the Black Lives Matter protests?
Yeah, I think there's a real opportunity for local impact to see both on, you know, in our Kansas City community and to see on both sides of the state line. Like People Power got the Kansas City, Kansas police chief to resign last year after some really damaging, really terrible acts were came out. You know, I think that we're seeing a movement on the Missouri side as well. I was out there and tear gassed, you know, along with the ridiculous police presence early on in the protests. I was happy to see the mayor's leadership to reduce that, and I think the Black Lives Matter call to take money away from these enforcement and criminalization mechanisms and put them back into the communities that they have been terrorizing, it would be a revolution, and I'm here for it and want to see that through, that we can really say Black Lives Matter, and then we would all be safer.
Thank you. I'd like to encourage all of our listeners to visit the Deportation Defense Legal Network's website. There are interviews of our people here and other Black immigrants that can speak to this. So visit ddlnkc.org. And thank you for being with us today. Bill?
Bob, just a housekeeping thing. Could you send me the recording? I didn't think to make a recording, but I believe you did, right? If you send it to me, we'll get it posted online so that you can go back and listen to it anytime you want. I want to thank Bob, Samantha, Katina, and Jessica for an outstanding discussion. Thank you so much. And this Thursday from 7 to 8, we'll deal with Black Lives Matter issues on a program called Stand Up. So tune in for that as well. Thanks again.
All right.
Thank you for having us.
Bye.
Thank you.
Okay, so.